Hello. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming this evening. I'm Catherine Lana, and on behalf of your local independent bookshop, Browsers, it's my great pleasure this evening to introduce Dan Snow, historian and broadcaster. And he's coming this evening, he's visiting us this evening to tell us about his new book, which hopefully many of you will have collected already. It's called On This Day in History. It's not officially released yet. We've got advance copies. Yes, it's officially published on Thursday. And this is Dan's first event, speaking event. So we're very honoured. He's going to be speaking to us for about 45 minutes. There's going to be plenty of time for questions. So think about what you'd like to ask him now, favourite dates and all that. And then there will be the opportunity to have your book signed at the end. And we'll give more details about that later. But perhaps we could give Dan a round of applause.
Thank you very much, everybody, for that very kind introduction, Catherine. That's very kind. It's very good to be here. Can you hear me on the radio? Is that okay? Can you hear me now? Good. I'll walk further from there. So it's a very special place for me to do because not only is it the site of the greatest ship burial in the Western world, just across something, of course, but it's a place where I almost died when I was a teenager. I'll tell you this little story. I wasn't going to tell it later, but I'll tell it now because I think it's important in understanding kind of the upbringing I had and the horrific trauma I suffered that drove me to become a presenter at Sir Thomas's time walking around castles in the rain. So Dan and I used to go on these holidays together. And I used to term holidays very cautiously because they're not what most people recognise holidays. It was brutal sailing adventures around Western Europe, into the North Sea, pre-GPS, young people, imagine that, with no GPS. We had to use charts like Captain Cook had done before us. And we left Amsterdam, we'd been looking at endless art galleries and battlefields and Boban-esque fortifications in the Low Countries. And we got in the boat, we sailed across, we went up the Thames estuary. And then the diesel got water in it. And so the engine stopped working. But we had sails, of course, the sails were up. And then the wind was howling and the sails tore. So we were there, we had no real way of propelling the boat through the water and the waves were crashing. And we were swept up the tide, ripped us up this east coast of England that's claimed to be a ship before now, as you all know. I didn't make the demon, but I got into the tidal atlas, and the tide was ebbing, it was rushing out, and the bar was going to, you guys know about the bar at the mouth of the demon. And we got over that bar with the last breath of wind. We had a mizzen and we had a storm jib that we found somewhere below. So we had a very scrappy sail. We just eked over the bar. And if we'd gone, we were just going to get stuck. And then as the sun was setting, it was a great epic of the Snow family, by the way. And I'm just sharing this. I haven't really talked about it for all these years because the first time I went back, very exciting. And we got over the bar, we dropped the anchor, and we all sort of collapsed. And it was a very, it was a deeply stressful and scary time, because if Dad, my mum, I was about 11, and my sisters were like 9 and 7 or something. I mean, it's quite convention. And we look back at Dad, kept a log, diary of all the sailing trips we've ever done. And we look back at it, and we all remember it particularly. And we read it the other day, and Dad writes it in the third person, a bit weird, like Julius Caesar, Dad Forbes. He goes, Peter did this, and I think it's his one day he thought we'd all contribute to writing this long book, but no one ever did, it was always that. So he wrote, Peter, rather worried by this stage, we were being thrown north by the tide, blah, 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 but fortified by a shot of scotch. I'm like, hold on, Dad. We went down, so he went down below decks, we were like sort of sailing, he went down below decks, went to the drinks cabinets, took a massive slug of whiskey, and he came back on deck. Unbelievable! So that was that. And that was my experience. So I feel that whenever I have been to this Woodford Port, I came to this wonderful Woodford Port because I came to your wonderful school, which Mike Street is the stalwart of, and he used to be a t- teacher of mine at St Paul's in London, and he's one of the main reasons that I'm here tonight. Wonderful teacher, and always gave me wonderful advice and help through their difficult teenage years. And so I come to do a prize giving at your school, which is great, so it's very nice to be back. But my first trip was the most traumatic, I have to say, the near-death experience on you. But that story is the reason that I'm here today. I'm going to talk about this new book and everything, you are going to receive the first copies of this, but really on sale. It's very exciting, so thank you for those of you who are clutching it in your sweaty palms. I'll write nice things in it because I'm so grateful. You know that thing when you release a book, you're completely terrified of it. But the story for me begins, my love of history begins as a child. People always say to me, you must have been a teacher at school. And I'd be honest with you, yeah, but the damage was already done by that stage. I mean, school was late in the day in my historical career. We used to go to school in our family down break, quite frankly. Our holidays were just brutal historical excursions around various windswept outposts in the northwest of Eurasia, from northern Norway, the Irish coast. I mean, my God, it brings some shivers to me. I don't think I particularly enjoyed these excursions. I mean, I was free, strapped to a backpack or a boat or a knackered old car on an off-road track trying to find an Iron Age settlement. And I don't think I enjoyed it particularly. I was cold, I was scared, I didn't know what the hell was going on. But then I got Stockholm Syndrome, and it just sort of grew from it. And now, I promised myself? I promised when I have kids, if by any chance I've ever grown up. I didn't really believe it. I don't think when you're young you actually believe it. I don't think you actually appreciate the history of something that's happened, because you think the universe began when you were born. I instinctively understood that the past had actually happened. When I got to about 25, I thought, oh, this doesn't stop. These numbers keep going up. And I think until that point, I still didn't really believe that the pony ever existed. I was fascinated by the pony, but I couldn't really internalize that it existed. Anyway, so when I was young, I thought, this is pointless, and I'm never going to flip this on my children. I strapped my kids into my speedboat, whizzing around Solent, looking at Victorian coastal batteries, shipwrecks at low tide. I got the kids up at 5:30 the other morning to go look at a particular shipwreck on the Needles, a 1949 Greek steamer sank delivering fruit to the UK just after the war, crashed straight at the Needles, and you can still see the boiler at a very, very, very low tide. The boiler just uncovers, very exciting, to astronomical low tide, about 2 days a year, and unfortunately about 5:30 in the morning. So I dragged everyone out, and unfortunately also, it was meant to be totally still, so I got everyone on the boat, low tide, out of things, everyone's freezing, it was meant to be hot, freezing, miserable, and then also it was quite choppy that day, because the wind had come up from nowhere, so we couldn't really see the boiler, and I thought my wife was actually going to kill me, to be honest. My youngest daughter is two. She's been to HMS Victory
three times.
And people say to me, oh, that's great, your kids love history. I've got absolutely no idea, I've never asked them. I doubt they do, but I don't think they know it. So in my family, we got history with our mother's milk. People think about my dad who's been telling us history, but actually the wellspring of history in our family is my grandma, my great nine. And she's responsible, really, I suppose, for this book. She's certainly responsible for much about my life. She was an Indian carrier from North Wales. The Welsh have a wonderful storytelling tradition. They're all historians. She would tell me stories about our past, tell me stories about our ancestors. Most of them are completely made up. She would tell me that we were descended from Llywelyn the Great, Owain Glyndwr, King Arthur, obviously featured very prominently. Not from the West Country. Not that you Angles would care about King Arthur, but no. She told me that she weaved these very vivid stories, and they told me a couple of things. First of all, she gave me this powerful sense that the past had happened. You know, I was sort of talking earlier. She gave me a powerful sense of the past was as vivid and as exciting as the present, as colourful as the present. The past was never lists of dead kings and dates. The past was Cousin Garonway, who was the first man from that slate quarry to go on the blind Alphastinian train, educate himself, go off the university, improve it. You know, it was stories about this sprawling Welsh dissenting family, lay preachers, people who used education to get ahead and better themselves, who worked in unions and expanded and emigrated to Canada and lived a kind of a North American dream. And so she gave me this, and she also really gave me this powerful sense that what happens in the past is directly, not just influences, but controls the present. Because there's me, I was a kid living in London with a Canadian mum, a Welsh grandma, a Dublin-born English farmer with a big nose and bad teeth. And I didn't understand my existence unless I understood, obviously, the decisions that had been made before I was born. History clearly had delivered me to that place at that time. I could have been a completely different person. I could have been born in Syria. I could have been born in the Congo. But no, I was born in Southwest London, an affluent family. And that was because of decisions that were made. It's because my mum went to the fateful press conference in Ottawa, where she met a tall Englishman with receding hairline, with big nose and bad teeth, for the crew, as you mentioned. And it started raining outside. And he walked up to her and said, "I have an umbrella." I'm not sure I'm sharing the biggest story, but this occurs to me. And so he had further, and he walked her back to the hotel very gently, and one thing after another, and I was born thereafter. So my grandmother made me understand, my nine understand, my entire existence was because of decisions that were made before I was born. So although these people, these black and white photos on the wall, the people that she was telling me about may have ceased to exist long ago, their decision to emigrate to Canada, their decision to go to university, their decision to move to London, those were decisions that defined my life. And so I've never had problems understanding that we're on a continuum from the past, rooted deep, deep into our past, that runs through the present and will continue after we are gone. And so I grew up with that passion, loving history. I grew up doing history. I mean, if you put a dot on my house in South London, where I grew up, and then you draw a 250-mile radius around that house, we've been to every single abbey, cathedral, battlefield, castle, stately home, gallery, and museum within that circle. And loaded into the back of the car every single weekend. That's what we did, as I mentioned at the beginning, our sailing holiday, our holidays, everything revolved around these kind of adventures against the historical sites. So therefore when I've always found it very neat. So people say to me, "How do you get everyone else interested in history?" I go, "I've got no idea, you're asking the wrong person. I love history. Don't ask me how to get other people interested in history. I've got no idea, I don't know how it happened in our family." But I have noticed over the course of now a disturbingly long time, making television programs for the BBC, I'm very lucky to do, radio programs, now podcasts, which for those who don't know are like radio programs. It's like having Radio 4 without having to listen to the Archers. Great blessing. So I now have my own podcast called History Hit, and I just interview historians every week and veterans of World War II and just broadcast that to the internet, they get listened around the world by millions of people, it's very exciting. And what I've noticed doing all of that stuff is that normal people who haven't been brutalized into the love of history as children find anniversaries a key portal. Some find family history is very important, others find that anniversaries are a way in. So actually, when you think about it, that's not hugely surprising, because there's one big anniversary that we're all obsessed by. We all choose a day of the year on which we were born to get rather depressed or get very happy and spoil yourself and think about passing time and thinking about the nature of aging and all that kind of stuff. And it's a slightly arbitrary day because it happens when you're born or how many times you've been around the sun. And yet it's important to people. And of course, it's quite easy because also we mark Remembrance Sunday. As of the 11th, we mark the 11th of November. As we've just seen, it's a day on which the people that died in the First and Second World War, the veterans who are injured, who still need our ongoing support, actually, they're just as important every other day of the year. You know, I think about the First World War, Second World War every day of the year. But it's useful for people to have an anniversary because it can channel it, it can act as a portal. And so what I saw yesterday was for one day of the year, you see everyone, normal people, who don't live this stuff all the time, just going, Yeah, we need, okay, this is a day, it is the anniversary of the end of the First World War. It's a day on which I'm now connecting with that history. And I've seen it, I see you put out a program or a podcast or anything about the sinking of the Titanic, and then you put out again on the actual day on which it happened, the anniversary, the end of the spring day on which the Titanic crashed the iceberg, and it goes ballistic, everyone cares about it on that one day. No one cares about it 364 days a year, everyone cares about it on that one day. So, over the course of my career, I thought I basically was able to assemble this great database of dates and events and facts and things that I found fascinating. And then eventually I talked to a publisher and I thought, what if I try and stick this all in one book? So all of the, if I've gone and I have, let's think of an example, but yeah, well, let's think of November the 11th. I made a really fascinating program on the last people to die on November 11th. Tragic story. Imagine you survive the whole war. They agree in the armistice at 5 in the morning. And then for dramatic wait, they say, let's ceasefire on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And that's pretty grim for the, that's something like 11,000 people, actually. Perhaps it's not that it's fate. So around about 11,000 people, I think, were killed or wounded between dawn, 5 a.m. when the armistice signed, and the ceremonial end, the cessation of fighting on the Western Front. Tens of thousands of people killed and wounded. Partly because Americans in particular had only just entered the war, a lot of ambitious officers were quite, they realised the army was going to shrink right back as soon as the war finished, so they wanted to prove themselves, lead one or two last important attacks, cover themselves with glory, win a medal. Partly because people were just using up ammunition. Partly because the message didn't get through, perhaps, you know, to absolutely every unit. And so people were killed right up, and partly because they didn't know, it was a ceasefire, it was an armistice, it wasn't unconditional. It wasn't like VE Day when it's clear the German regime had completely collapsed. So a lot of commanders were thinking, right, if the fighting's going to start again, I want to be up on that ridge, I don't want to stop down in this valley. So that one last offensive, you'd order to try and take that final ridge, that final strong point. And that meant on the morning of the 11th of November, thousands of people killed or wounded. And the last Briton killed or wounded, or killed, George Ellison, about 9:30 in the morning, so an hour and a half before the armistice, killed in Mons, which is exactly where the fighting had started over 4 years before. And he'd been present at the Mons fighting 44. He was a pre-war regular soldier. He had made it through the whole of the First World War on the Western Front. By some miracle, he'd made it. He was 40 years old, so prime of life. Absolute prime of life. He's quite young, in fact, 40 years old. And he had made it, and he managed to go to self kill and from an enemy sniper, and he left behind a 4-year-old son, Elise, and a wife. I mean, it's a totally tragic story. And he is buried. This is bizarre. He is buried opposite John Parr, who was the first on the Western Front in the First World War in August 1914, and it is a total coincidence. The reason they know it's a coincidence is because Parr was misidentified. He was only identified as John Parr in the 1980s. So Ellison was buried opposite the first casualty on the Western Front of the First World War. And that symmetry, the fact that it was the fighting began in Mons and ended in Mons, the fact that the first and the last Brits killed were opposite each other in this same cemetery, Santa Sporting Cemetery, it has given rise to this idea of the war, this popular idea, which I don't think is entirely true, but as a war of total pointlessness, of just circularity, of utter futility. And then there was a man called Lawrence Price, Canadian, so the last British Imperial soldier killed 10:58 a.m. yesterday, 100 years ago yesterday. He killed a group of Belgian villagers for celebrating, saying thank you for liberating us. A group of Canadians was sort of hanging out with them. And a random shot from a tall building just down the road, not clear if it was intentional or not, felled, mortally wounded Price. And he died, he was shot, mortally wounded at 10:58, and as the bell struck 11, he died, apparently, according to one of his comrades. Also, that story reminds me of the fact that Wilfred Owen was killed 100 years ago last weekend, 7 days to go. Until he was killed within about, almost to the hour, 7 days, a week before the armistice, Wilfred Owen. And his mother in Shrewsbury received the telegram as the church bells were ringing out for victory. So she thought her boy had won the war, and there was a knock at the door, even though the town was celebrating and into that war. And so all of that history is fascinating, but there's something about the fact that it's on the day, I think, is something that connects people to that particular history. Other people have other ways of connecting with the past. I mean, some people find anniversaries exciting, some people find family history very interesting, and then also there's the community local history, which I think is great. And I'm afraid to say, I have an admission to make, everybody, you're not going to be happy with this, but I did have an absolute peach of an anniversary that got cut from the final edit of this book, and that is my favourite invasion of England. You know, people say Tennessee is the last invasion of England. I mean, absolute arrogant nonsense. As you know, he's always been honest. You're a history fan. I mean, England was invaded constantly over the 700 years that followed 1066. But one of the more amusing invasions took place right here in Orford, and it was the 24th of September 1336. And this made it right down to the last edit of the book. The trouble is, I discovered there were just too many mad Plantagenet invasions in the book, and one had to go. That's my favourite for the following reason, which is that the invading force, so Edward II, totally useless king, was invaded from the Low Countries by a force of mercenaries, very true, isn't it? Commanded by his wife. And that's brutal. And his wife and her lover, who he exiled, locked him up and got rid of him, of course, in the legendary execution in British history. Sadly, probably not true, but that's the one with the old red hot poker in the place where it hurts the most. Edward II thus made way for his wife and her lover, and until Edward III, his son was able to oppose them in turn. So that's the one. Sorry, the invasion happened at the mouth of the Orford River, so that's just very, very near here. What has made it into the book from this area? Tragically, something who is not in this book, which is a grotesque oversight. Dunwich is very good. I'm sure lots of you are fans of Dunwich, one of the great medieval ports of England. Two storms in the late 13th century swept Dunwich into the sea, thus making for two interesting reasons, what I'll talk about, which basically destroying the port. And now, I don't know if there's anyone here, but I went diving in Dunwich with some scuba enthusiasts. Anyone done scuba diving off Dunwich around here? Right. You're very hardcore. This young lady in the front row had done it. And what the rest of you may not know is that it's something called zero-vis diving. I thought, how bad for that? And then I discovered, am I right? Is zero-vis, or I can nod exactly? You cannot see your hand in front of your face. You go into the water. I have no idea, and I'm rubbish at diving, but I always pretend I've done all diving in the house so I get on TV. So I go in the water, and I'm sort of floating around. One minute I was on the bottom, the next minute my head came up on the surface of the water, and I had no idea. I was upside down, I was inside out, and you can't see. But these crazy people love it, because of course all the other divers haven't been through and cleaned out all the good stuff. So if you are into the zero-vis diving, because no one else is insane enough to do it, you can find shipwrecks and look at, you know, bits of medieval Dunwich. And so I went down and dived on Dunwich, which was a great exciting thing to do. And Dunwich, my love is the 18th century, my first love is the 18th century, and what I like about Dunwich is it became one of the ultimate rotten boroughs. You know what a rotten borough is? Where by the early 19th century, the franchise that had been agreed in the 13th and 14th century to send members to Parliament, this new idea of a Parliament where you go and advise the king. So each borough would send two people, or so borough sent two people, the county sent two people. So for example, Dunwich had two MPs, even though Dunwich no longer existed, effectively. It was in the sea. And Manchester had zero MPs, which of course by the early 19th century was becoming untenable. And so eventually in 1832 Reform Act, they swept all that great format, they swept away poor old Dunwich, lost its MPs, as in places like Old Sarum, which had been the site of Salisbury, where nobody lived there at all. The landowner controlled Old Sarum, and he just whoever rented his cottages, he said, you can please vote for these people. And so there was a franchise of about six people, all of whom had to do what the landowner told them. So that's Dunwich. And then there's the great Also, what's in, is also in the story, which I'm very interested by, is the great, on the 31st of January, the great flood of 1953, which affected Canvey Island and Essex quite a lot. I know it affected Norfolk. I presume it wasn't great here. Not any Canvey fatalities in Suffolk? Felixstowe was seriously hit, wasn't it? Yeah, that makes sense. And then, I know it's not here, and I don't want to be rude to you, but Essex, just across the border. we do have the 14th of November, the Battle of Maldon in 991, this remarkable Viking victory against the defending Anglo-Saxons, the second great wave of Viking, of Dane intrusion into Britain, following the early assaults of the great heathen armies of the 9th century. You get the 10th century assaults that end finally in Danish conquest. Canute becomes king. Canute died today, by the way. It's Canute's death day. And if he lived, or if he had a decent son, none of us would be in this mess. It'd still be part of a joyful, great Scandinavian united empire, which I think is quite similar. Anyway, I digress. So yes, so the Battle of Maldon is very remarkable indeed. I'm so fascinated by the First World War in East Anglia. No one knows this. I mean, this is the most remarkable fact. This is one of the most remarkable facts. The First World War is such an interesting war. People think of it as a time of stalemate and nothing changed, nothing really happened. And it actually was a time of extraordinary innovation, a time of absolutely unimaginable innovation. And one area you see that, of course, is heavy-air flight only started around 10 to 12 years before the First World War. So these people are trying to work out a fight in the air. The technology is so primitive, it's not even funny. And Kaiser Wilhelm launches the first strategic bombing campaign in human history. Aerial strategic bombing campaign in human history. The idea, the first thing, people had dropped the odd bomb out of the odd plane before North Africa and Caucasus and the Balkan. But this was a strategic campaign. We are going to knock the enemy out of the war by bombing them from the sky. Okay? And it's an idea that still obsesses people today. We want to believe that we don't have to commit our young men and women, our infantry to these conflicts. We can just send planes and drones and rain down fire on people and they'll do what we want. And this idea starts in 1915 with Kaiser Wilhelm, and he sends his airships against England. He did not allow West London to be bombed. He draws a line down what would now be described as the Kingsland Road. You're not allowed to go west there because you might hit Bucky, might hit his family members. So he absolutely says we're not allowed to bomb West London. And that's true. And the first attempt to bomb, strategic bombing in the history of the world, ends up, they head for Humberside, they get blown out of the way, and they end up dropping bombs on Great Yarmouth. And you think, what an extraordinary thing. You run in a thread from Great Yarmouth through to London, Coventry, Tokyo, and Hiroshima, and Nagasaki, right up to the present day. But isn't that fascinating? That's where it starts. I've always thought that was such a bizarre. They're totally off course. They see the English coast, and then that'll do. They drop some bombs, and they achieve virtually nothing at all. So I've always found that particularly remarkable in history. Also here, we've also got in, I think it's the 12th of June, I think the rowing club are here in force tonight, aren't they? Got any rowers in the house? Okay, yeah, a few rowers. By the way, force, that's two. Three. I think Catherine was trying to build the rowing club's partners. Well, I didn't see rowers in the plural dust. Anyway, so the first Doctor came in progress in there as well, which is... So I should probably talk about the book rather than just endlessly chatting about history. The idea of this book is that I've tried to choose a date that the story is engaged in, it's always fascinating and unusual and surprising, of course, and it will be hopefully something people don't really know. But it will also be important. It will also, every single one of these 365 entries, or 366, if the case is gap here, when you read it, will shed, I think, shed light. The ambition is that it will shed light on some force that has shaped the modern world. So from the introduction of glass milk bottles into the British countryside in the 19th century through to the invention of Google, through to, of course, the Battle of Waterloo and D-Day. It's just each day I hope will shed light on an aspect of our modern lives and the nature of our world today. And I think what's been extremely popular, I've got about 10 minutes left before we have questions. What has been very, well, basically, is you never know if you're going to use a book until you see it. And what every single person has done so far when they pick up this book is they go, that's a nice looking book, and they start looking, and I go, you didn't even go back there. Is that what you think? Well, there you go, so what's your birthday? Let's share it with everybody. Don't tell me what year, but what's the date?
1st of May.
1st of May, here we go. Stand by. This might, let's see what it's like. Well, it's May. I probably could have done it on an actual. But I bet most of you don't know why May Day came about. May Day, it was, in terms of its socialist connection, in terms of its labour connections, it was May 1889, May 1886, there was a massive strike in Chicago, and the strike breakers came in and shot a huge number of striking workers. In 1889, 3 years later, at the first sort of Socialist International, it was agreed that there would be an international day to mark the struggle, organised labour, and it would be on the day when this strike began in Chicago. And it was May Day. And of course, it's quite nice. It coincided with this older pagan idea about the coming of May. And so now we have a strange hybrid. We have both the drinking and the riotousness associated with the older pagan traditions of May Day, but with a twist of anti-capitalist acts as well. So people would imagine these sorts of people marching around with pictures of Lenin on their t-shirts. So yeah, May Day is quite a good one. That's an easy one. Well, what are the birthdays we've got out there? Shout out birthday, anybody?
3rd of October.
Everyone's got a birthday. Usually, if you guys say any questions, if no one's got questions, then fair enough, you have questions. But if you're not asking on your birthday, then I know I've lost the audience. Right. 3rd of October. Oh. 3rd of October. Who's heard of Bill Coltman? Bill Coltman, one of the most remarkable heroes of the First World War, in fact, of British history. He was a pacifist who was a member of the Plymouth Brethren. He signed up to the First World War, not to shoot a rifle or to use bayonets, but to carry stretchers. And on the very remarkable 48 hours from the 3rd of October onwards in 1918, he spent a huge amount of time on enemy fire on the battlefield, bringing back wounded comrades from a fairly unsuccessful attack against German lines in late 1918. And he spent about 48 hours, he dropped down exhausted at the end of it, and he rescued dozens of people, and he was given the Victoria Cross. He was sat alongside two Distinguished Conduct Medals, two military medals, which is extraordinary, making him, Lance Corporal Bill Coltman, the most decorated soldier in the British Empire. So he received his medals for saving lives, not for taking them, which I've always thought is rather wonderful. He became a gardener after the war and never wanted to talk about his wartime service, so no one knew he'd done that. Extraordinary. Anyone on the birthday? How do you do the front? Anyone on the back? Shout for birthday out the back. I'm the 3rd of December, so that's very, very, very good. Nice Sagittarian, fellow Sagittarian. 9 December. Ooh, a literary one for you, madam. So this one is, yeah, well, this is, I'll be absolutely honest with you. There are some days of the year that are real tricky. Where absolutely nothing happens. And on those days, I've seen a few of these books out and about over the course of my life. And when you see, oh, it's someone's birthday, or, you know, I think that's rubbish, come on. I want it to be a day on which something remarkable happened. But on the 9th of December, I failed. And so I put someone's birthday. But very, very rare, I can promise you that. And it is John Milton's birthday today, who wrote Paradise Lost, which is the sort of one of the foundational texts of English literature, completely remarkable. But John Milton also had a very, very, very colourful life. He was one of the chief propagandists for the Commonwealth against the parliamentarians of Oliver Cromwell's regime in the mid-17th century. He was given the rather remarkable title, whereas I'm going to get it absolutely right, it's totally brilliant. He was given the title Secretary for Foreign Tongues. Like a foreign minister, very good. King Charles thought about killing him when he got back. He was on a list of people who could be prescribed. King Charles II had the intelligence that his useless father and younger brother lacked. And so the reason King Charles II, apart from Oliver Cromwell, as you'll know, Oliver Cromwell had been dead for several years by the time King Charles II got back to the throne. Around about 2 years by the time Charles II got to the throne. And he dug up Oliver Cromwell's remains from St. Margaret's Church in Westminster, next to Westminster Abbey. He hand drawn and quartered these remains and then displayed them around the country. So he didn't like Oliver Cromwell, of course, but he forgave lots of other people. And it's brilliantly, John Milton really demonstrates why Charles II was right through it, because he just went home and wrote wonderful books and chilled out for the rest of his life. He represented no threat to the Stuart regime. And so Charles II's humanity was well rewarded. And he had a very canny political sense there. So, 9th and 7th, very good one. Anyone else?
26 November,
King, straight off the mark. Let's see. I was really impressed. I learned every single one of these. This is my first event. 26th November, here we go. Ah, lucky you. Vlad Dracula became prince and ruler of Wallachia three times. And today was the last time, in 1476. So, Vlad the Impaler was, if you had to choose a time to be born, a place to be born, Eastern Europe in the 15th century would have been pretty low on the list. It's pretty grim. So, unimaginable instability. Vlad the Impaler was a local prince who found himself wedged between competing states, the Ottoman Empire expanding to the south, a terrible war of religious and ethnic, aggravated by religious and ethnic differences, vicious. He chased off the throne twice. He ends up becoming king, but ends up dying in appalling circumstances very shortly afterwards. He was as nasty as the propaganda says. He dissuaded his enemies from attacking him by just skewering his enemies on great spikes and leaving fields of skewered enemies to dissuade the opposition from attacking him. So that's a very bloodthirsty birthday, sir. Anybody else?
November 12th,
that's today. I know what today is, but I've signed it off now, so I can just check it down again. Here we go. Oh, yes, interesting one today. So, Mary the First of England, first queen regnant in European, in British, the first queen ruling by herself, not because she has a male husband who's really in charge. So she becomes queen, and today she passed a religious settlement to bring England back to Catholicism. And she undoes 25 years worth of religious law passed by Henry VIII and her brother Edward VI. It doesn't, of course, she married King Philip of Spain, which is incredibly unpopular. She then dies without producing an heir, and her Protestant sister Anne Boleyn's daughter, Elizabeth I, becomes queen. And I think what's really important about this day is that it was an attempt in Britain so England could easily have been turned back to the place back under the papal yoke. The first Brexit had been reversed. Historians' heads explode when you say that. So just a little light And it failed because of the succession, because of the capriciousness of the womb. And so Elizabeth I came in and replaced Mary's settlement with a Protestant settlement. And that was the one that endured. And Mary got a bad reputation. She was called Bloody Mary because her sisters, pamphleteers and historians, got to write history books. Elizabeth shared many of the proclivities of her older sister of torturing and killing her political and religious enemies. But Elizabeth's remembered as Gloriana, and Mary is remembered as the bloody poor thing. Here you go, before you go for questions, I want to give you a chance. Yeah, well, let's just do one. Anyone else shout out birthday over there?
July.
Well, I'll tell you, it's probably going to be a big one. Because what I've learned writing this book is much more stuff happened in the summer. and I'm only half joking about that, actually, because in terms of military history, obviously, in northern climes, in the northern hemisphere, the northern summer was the time when armies would march. And March is the month of Mars, the month of the Roman god of war. It's the month when you march, and the grass is starting growing, and you can feed the horses. You can't march before March. You can't leave before March because you have to carry fodder for the horses. It's just too inefficient to do that. So once March comes, those green blades are poking up through the earth, then the army can move and the horses can. The horses, which do all the transport of people and goods, logistics, they can feed themselves on the way. That's very important. So that's why March is called March. And so from then, and then about September, October, you get a spate of brutal battles because you get anxious generals trying to finish up campaigns before the onset of the winter rains. So you get all that. But then you've got lots of big battles. But on that note, the 3rd of July, speaking of which, what a treat. You did take 3rd of July, didn't you? Yes, exactly. Well, 3rd of July, the high watermark of the Confederacy. You probably know this. The Battle of Gettysburg, one of the most decisive battles in North America, possibly the world history. The Southern armies, commanded by General Robert E. Lee, one of the greatest commanders in the history of the world, have invaded the North. They are threatening Washington, D.C. They have closed, they have surrounded the Northern Army on three sides in a vice-like grip. The Northern Army are holding out on top of a ridge, Cemetery Ridge, and they are proving stubborn. But if they are defeated, it will be the end. It is likely that Britain, France, and other countries will recognize the South despite their embrace of slavery. If the South wins, it seems like England would have been forced to make negotiated peace, recognizing the independence of the South. And this is the great moment. Robert E. Lee makes the most catastrophic error of judgment. Well, apart from his error of judgment, which is supporting the South anyway, which he should have done. He makes the most extraordinary tactical error of judgment, and he launches a massive attack up this great open slope towards entrenched enemy infantry armed with accurate rifles and accurate artillery. And it's what's fascinating is if anyone had been paying attention, they would have seen the ensuing slaughter and thought, not a great idea that. And this was 1860, you know, this was 50 years before the First World War. And it's as if the lessons of that day were not learned. So the Confederates launched the largest artillery bombardment of the war so far, but did very little damage. They then march up this slope and suffer unimaginable casualties. But at the top of that, they managed to get to within some of them break into Union lines, there's bayonet fights, close hand-to-hand fighting, and it's called by historians the high watermark of the Confederacy. That is as close as the Southern states came. The men that got into those entrenchments were the absolute, as close as Southern states came to their independence. And as the casualties were too often, they swept back downhill and defeated rabble with around a third or half of their number left on the battlefield. And Robert E. Lee, in tears, went among the survivors, weeping, apologising. They knew the damage was done. The Northern Army would survive, and the Southern troops would have to retreat back into the South, and they would lose permanently the initiative in the American Civil War, meaning America was free to become one nation, and eventually this giant hegemonic power that stretched from coast to coast and became the largest and most powerful military force in the history of the world, and the largest and richest country in the history of the world. And had it not been for that fateful day, it might have all been so very different. And the charge is named after one of the brigadier generals, who Robert E. Lee went, "Form up your brigade," and he said, "Sir, I have no brigade." His name was Pickett, General Pickett, become the So that's a huge moment in history. So that's kind of the idea, and I just wanted each story to be fascinating, sort of unusual and interesting, and go from Chinese history to the history of the Atlantic slave trade to the history of science and engineering, and also a bit of military history and political history as well. And each day I just want us to have a little pause and think about how our past has shaped us. Anybody, I want to ask a question now, that's fine, even if you want to shout your birthday out, we can do a bit more of that if you found that diverting. We've got about, I think, 10 minutes or so, haven't we? Yeah.
10,
15
minutes.
Yeah, so, any questions? There's no microphones, so you're just going to have to shout out and I'll be quick. Anything you have to be able to talk about, anything you want.
What's your favourite event in history?
What's my favourite event in history, for those of you who didn't hear, which none of you didn't hear that, very good, well projected. My favourite event in history, well, it's quite a hard one, perhaps. I think of everything that's ever happened. I think I went to Qualifying Music Festival about 4 years ago. Okay, so favourite event in history. I think it's very difficult this. Because it changes as I learn more. There's things I find fascinating. I'm glad I wasn't there, but I find the Battle of Trafalgar just incredibly absorbing. I can't read enough about it. I find it extraordinary, the idea of these massive oak-hulled ships sailing towards each other at 1 mile an hour, unleashing broadsides at point-blank range, sweeping enemies dead clear, casualties similar to those of the First World War, appalling destruction, the chaos of battle, the smoke, the sound, what it looked like, those beautiful ships. HMS Victory, as I say, I've taken my board there 3 times, I'm obsessed by it, and the idea that you have 40 of those ships, not including other smaller ships, all in one place at that time. I find that fascinating. But that makes me sound like I'm sort of blunt. So my favourite event, it's very difficult. Yikes. I probably should have an answer to that, really. I've been reading a lot recently about the Field of the Cloth of Gold. It feels completely remarkable. 500 years ago, next year, the year after next, Henry VIII and Francis I, it's in the book as well, actually, they cover a field outside Calais with gold, they build a city there for the attendants. There was a wine fountain in the middle, which they had to turn off, because obviously the English just got too wasted, and there were just piles of English bodies around the wine fountain in the morning. Henry VIII wrestled Francis I, and lost, incredibly embarrassing. They left with these great protestations of friendship, and within a year they were at war. So I find that's just a wonderful, colourful story. I find anything to do with Greek and Roman history so fascinating. It's a really hard question. I'm going to keep thinking of things. I'll just keep blurting out during other answers. Anybody else? Okay, thank you, and then Madam, I'll do yours in a second, so go for that, thank you. If I had a time machine, who would I like to have met? But again, it's very difficult, because I would love to have met Nelson, he was extraordinarily charismatic. Everyone who met him said he had radiated this remarkable sense of leadership. You've got to be pretty tough to be a sailor in the Georgian Navy. You've been around Cape Horn a few times. You're not going to be that enamoured with officers and hierarchy stuff. And that when old salts, when they heard they'd been killed at Trafalgar, they broke down in tears. That's pretty remarkable. I would like to have met Elizabeth I, and what an extraordinary, wily, brilliant, cunning, deft human being. She must have been brave. And I'd love to just ask her about it. I'd love to ask her about everything. Love to have met Napoleon Bonaparte. So many characters. I'd love to have met the Cecil family, 3 generations, a bit in the very heart of English courtly life, and Casanova, actually. Funny enough, not for the sort of obvious, lots of things, because of course now that doesn't seem quite as exciting because people are more relaxed about our sexual habits. But he just lived a life of extreme adventure. Constantly dueling, being shot and stabbed by lovers' husbands, imprisoned, escaping from prisons. At the end of his life, sort of knackered old man, pockmarked face, he on his deathbed, he just said, "I can say that I have lived." And I suspect they did live a bit harder than we do. They must have been. I was kind of this 18th century boxer the other day, this prize fighter. And he turns up in the 18th century, he turns up in the Caribbean, in New York, and in London, and he's born in sort of Birmingham or something. You think they got round a lot more than we think. You know, the North Atlantic was more, you know, more traversable than we might think today it was. And he was, and you know, there were mutinies. He escaped battles, and we don't really know we've been born today. And he would have had stories, you know. He made his money by being a bare knuckle prize fighter, and you know, his life had been. He's like a historical model, a completely remarkable man. So, lots of people that I just discovered. I mean, Qin Shi Huangdi, first emperor of China. Of all the humans who've ever lived, you know, the older I get, the more I'm convinced that my childhood was talking about great generals and great commanders and great politicians. I think that might not be true. You know, I think the people that have moved the dark, the people that have built the world are probably the engineers, the scientists, the thinkers. I mean, I think Aristotle, I think Marie Curie, I think those people have had more impact on our lives today. I think today our lives are more impacted. I think Donald Trump probably isn't very important. Well, he keeps his little fingers away from that nuclear trigger. I don't think you actually have much influence over things. I think Elon Musk does, I think Jeff Bezos does, and Charlie Amazon, I think they control our lives. And so I think that, but my point being, going back to Charlie, if there is one individual who has changed the course of history in a way that we used to think Napoleon and Hitler and Churchill was going to do, I think it's the first emperor of China, Qin Shi Huangdi. China in 2nd century BC looked much like Europe. Different countries, different currencies, different languages and alphabets. And Qin Shi Huangdi united them all into a whole Qin Empire, China. And ever since then, effectively, with a bit of trouble, China has been one empire, one nation, and the idea of China has exercised this huge centrifugal force on the other bits. They might occasionally break off under warlords, but they always come back. So in the way that Charlemagne's empire, the way that the Roman Empire, the way that Plantagenet Empire never survived, Canute's Empire never survived that long, Qin Shi Huangdi's empire did. And he unified it. I mean, he was an EU bureaucrat, let me tell you that. He made sure all the wagons of the empire, a wagon of the same diameter, so that all the ruts would be in the same place across the empire. The money, the script, he burned everything he didn't like, he killed people. It was pretty brutal. But it did set the framework, foundations for one of the world's most significant and powerful empires over the following 2,000 years. So yeah, I would love to have met him. Well, I say that, I mean, Dick Sander was a fairly nasty person. He's the guy that built the Terracotta Army, the Terracotta Warriors. He built this vast army, 7,000 that we've discovered so far, highly coloured, garishly painted, but underground. No one's ever meant to see. No, they were covered up, built in those tunnels underground, with real weapons, possibly sculpted to be portraits of representations of real members of his army. Very remarkable, that's not the best place to go. Anyway, Madam.
If you could change one event in history, would you want to be with or which one would
it be? He's the best one. Kidding. Can I have a lunch? Well, that's a huge. Well, actually, you know, of course, is your answer you want to go back and make sure they discover antibiotics 2,000 years earlier so that not so many people die in appalling pain from preventable diseases? But I think that's kind of a bit abstract, really. And I think probably actually the quite simple answer is in front of us, which is Archduke Franz Ferdinand. The First World War had more of an impact on the world than the Second World War. Unpopular opinion, but it's true. The First World War took a world dominated by the great European empires and completely smashed it to bits. The Middle East, the problems in the Middle East today are a direct result of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire 100 years ago, defeated by France. Israel exists as a result of decisions made during that war. And Ottoman Turkey was an ally of Britain and France for centuries. Went to war against them very accidentally in 1914. A complete fluke involving a German naval vessel that arrived in Istanbul at the wrong time. And so that first of the Middle East, Eastern Europe, it explodes into hundreds of different sectarian, national, religious groups as a result of the First World War. The Austro-Hungarian, like the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire kind of tottering, inefficient, weird, medieval hangover, but actually one that allowed, sort of kept a light grip on the potentially rather divided and divisive and troublesome territories that commanded the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburgs and the Ottomans, the two greatest enemies in the history of history, end up collapsing on the same team this month, 100 years ago. Completely bizarre. The Romanovs lose power in Russia. Russia has never recovered, really, from the Russian Revolution, the Civil War, and we had years of authoritarian communist rule. Chaos in the 1990s now repeated. So the First World War has shaped the world, I believe, in a way. I mean, Italian fascism, European socialism and fascism are direct product of the trauma of war. So I think if you could have, and that would have been an easy thing to change, because as you know, Gavrilo Princip had given up for the day. He was kind of strolling home, he was a bit depressed. The Archduke had driven down the apple and key, the road, the key leading to the town hall. Two of Princip's mates had tried to kill them. One had thrown a bomb that bounced off the Archduke's car and went under the car following, blew up, wounded quite severely some policemen in that car. The Archduke drove to the town hall, furious that he'd been attacked, gave a speech anyway. The speech had blood on it from one of his aides-de-camp who was sitting in the car behind him. Gave the speech, came back down, walked out of the airport, walked back onto the quayside. And the decision was made that he would go and visit the wounded soldiers in hospital, so they would deviate from the plan. No one told the driver of the Archduke's car. So the Archduke's car did two extraordinary things that both could have been avoided. One is it's all of the escort cars went off along the Apple Key, the quay down there. The Archduke's car turned inland. And as it turned inland, standing on the street corner on which it turned right, was Gavrilo Princip, who was feeling sorry for himself, the mission of the day having failed. Had the car kept going, it would have been fine because he would have whizzed past. Instead, the Archduke's bodyguard shouted at the driver, saying, "No, we're meant to be, we're not, we've changed the plan, we're going to the hospital." So the car stopped, and the driver stalled the engine. And so in front of Gavrilo Princip, with no other escort vehicles, no security around, apart from one security guard who dropped down on the runner board of the car, Gavrilo Princip just lifted up his weapon and fired at a range of 3 metres and shot the Archduke and his wife, grazing the jugular of the Archduke, and he died shortly afterwards. And that was just such an extraordinary chapter. It also happened that of all the people in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Archduke was the one who'd been who was passionately advocating for no war with Serbia. So they ended up killing the one man who within the apex of Austro-Hungarian power had been the one saying, "We cannot risk the empire's integrity to start a war with Serbia." So it's an appalling, and the death of tens of millions of people, the destruction of a type of, it wasn't perfect, of course, but the destruction of a world order which had produced unprecedented prosperity and peace in terms of cooperation, and the unleashing of extraordinary, extremist, violent, traumatized movements over the following decades. So that's probably what I'd change. Anybody else? Go on, sir.
Do you believe any war or going to fight has been justified?
It's quite difficult. I mean, historians and political international relations people get quite into the weeds and we start arguing about which one. I think it is important to start by saying that all wars are an abomination. But at the same time, I'm somebody who says, first of all the British Army were actually not as bad as everyone thinks, they kind of learned how to fight, they were quite impressive by it. That doesn't mean I don't regard the entire thing as an absolute disgrace and an appalling condemnation of everything we are as a human race. The fact that you can conscript young men and just send them off to march into machine gun fire, it's against men with whom they have no beef personally, is disgusting, but also it's a feature of our human condition, very depressing, and it's been going on since ancient Babylon. And before, in fact, if you look at hunter-gatherer societies, of course, the record and anthropological studies of contemporary groups. So it's deeply disturbing and depressing. Is it justified? I mean, I suppose a war is justified if you're all the good people of East Anglia and a load of Danes arrive on the shores and charge up. I think you're probably justified in fighting back, I guess. I mean, it's all just too depressing for words, really. When human society, when human groups come into contact with each other, they will conflicts will arise, you know, over resources and over pride and over women and over food and over, you know, of course, the scarcity. And we have several ways of resolving those conflicts. We can speak, use our mouths, and unfortunately, we can also use our fists. And so, I suppose, you know, that's like a defensive war against a notional enemy that's arrived one day, kind of is justified, I suppose, because deeply depressing. Well, that's happy now. I think, is that the end?
Yes, that's perfectly timed.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you very much.